Welcome back, everyone. This is the Loaf Podcast, where we break bread with the world's finest. Today, we're very lucky to be here with Oliver Berkman, renowned journalist and best-selling author of 4,000 Weeks. Unfortunately, he's also a Cambridge graduate, but we're just going to fly past that quickly. Oliver, thank you for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. So we're going to start right at the beginning. Of course, your most recent book is 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. And it's not really the kind of book you maybe expect from the title. I think you have quite a different definition of time management and productivity and those associated terms. So could you maybe begin by telling us what you think are the issues with the way people tend to understand time management and how you would go about redefining it, at least at a basic level, before we get into the detail?
Totally. And I apologize in advance if I'm going to be a bit relentlessly promotional about a book I've got coming out in a few weeks' time called Meditations for Mortals, which is on similar theme. And it's what, I mean, it develops it, I think, but it's where my head is at the moment. So apologies, and you can just cut me off and tell me that I'm being too promotional. I mean, I've always been obsessed on some level, going back to my time at Cambridge University, in which I was an absolute ball of anxiety, with using my time as well as I can and trying to feel in control of it and trying to feel like I don't have to disappoint anybody and I can meet all the deadlines, and then journalism will reinforce a lot of that. But what really struck me as I got to the point of writing 4,000 Weeks after several decades as an adult finding that these things didn't work the way they were promised, was that actually on some level time management is the main challenge of life, right? I mean, if you're going to really take seriously the fact that you've got finite time in the day, finite time in a life, and figure out how you're actually supposed to relate to that situation, then I guess you're doing time management. But it seems like something a bit deeper and more important than what we usually mean by that phrase. And anyway, in the subtitle of the book, Time Management for Mortals, I just kind of like the combination of a very sort of mundane idea with a very, grandiose one. So it's like, yeah, time management in light of the fact that one day you're going to die.
This is a bit of the way you've described that kind of got a question popping into my head now. How do you think time management would be different if we weren't mortal, if we're immortal?
Ha. Yeah, it's an interesting question, and one that one or two kind of people from a Christian background have sometimes sort of issued a challenge to me. It's like, well, I don't believe that we're mortal, so how does this change things? I think if what you mean is life just extended on forever, mm-hmm. So putting aside sort of more interesting ideas about what eternal life might mean, you just literally mean like you never died. Peter Thiel, Elon Musk solved the problem of death and we could just live for forever. If it was really forever, I think that would be absolutely terrible in every single way. And one of the things I've written about is like, it's sometimes a bit hard to get your mind around, but if you live forever, then the question of like, should I do this today or should I do it tomorrow? Or should I do X with my day today or should I do Y? Like the fundamental questions of building a meaningful life, the answer would always be like, who cares, right? Because you've got all the time in the world, literally. Now, if what really happened was that we just lived till we were like 200 or something, which I think is probably what a lot of these kind of Silicon Valley hype about solving death is about, that's a different matter. I can see some upsides. I think we would just replicate all the same problems though, and it would just seem like not enough very quickly.
So I just want to zero in and maybe make the conversation a little bit more mundane, maybe between different approaches that mortals might take to time management. I think what I meant by the rebranding that you particularly take is that time management really has a lot of associations with productivity. How well can we use our time? What can we get done, how much work, what can we tick off the to-do list? Busyness, for example, has been rebranded as hustle.
Yep.
What do you see as being wrong with that approach of using time in that way? And in using time as something effectively where you're kind of trying to gain an advantage for some future self?
Right. I mean, I think the fundamental problem you hint at in the end of that question, which is that if you take that purely instrumental approach to time, you're always trying to optimize. You're always trying to get to the situation where you can do more in order to become this better person later on, or in order to realize these goals later on, in order to make a certain amount of money later on. Your whole life is later on, and the whole sort of meaning of your life is postponed out into the future, and you sort of never actually kind of finding value in the present. I think also just that whole notion of light of time as something that is like a resource that it's up to us to use as well as we can. It's not untrue. We all have to approach life like that a bit, but I think it's something that like pre-industrial people would have been completely confused by, this idea that time is a resource. And I think that if you go too far down that down that avenue, you know, into that mindset, it really does kind of squelch something that is very important to the meaning of life, which is the sort of ability to feel like timelessness, like you're just sort of fully absorbed in the moment.
The pinnacle of that for me, actually, and you mentioned it in the book, but it reminded me of a couple of years ago, my dad bought a book which was something like rest better to work better, right? And even the idea that leisure, which should be an activity which is intrinsically valuable in itself, has become instrumentally valuable for work, for something else we can extract out of ourselves. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about the importance of hobbies and atelic activity for kind of getting a bit more in tune with time management for intrinsic worth as opposed to instrumental.
Yeah, no, this is the same point, but it's more a question of, as you say, like what you could do about it, which is that, you know, I think it's really useful and beneficial to have some activities in your life that you just do for their own sake. That I write in 4,000 Weeks about hiking, in my case, right? It's a sort of good example of a so-called atelic activity, an activity without an end that doesn't get its meaning from its destination. Because, like, you know, the quickest way to reach your destination when you go on a hike is just not to go on the hike. You're not doing it in order to get anywhere. There are sort of side benefits in terms of cardiovascular health, but that's not really why most people say, not why I go hiking. And then I also give the example of sort of hobbies that you're kind of not even that good at. I think can often people find a huge amount of freedom in those. I wrote in the book about Rod Stewart's incredibly elaborate model train system, which is like nothing to do with his like personal branding as a rock star. If anything, it works against it. And secondly, by all accounts, he's like, you know, he has to hire people to build all the special bits of his difficult bits of his model railway network. And he's obviously got the money to do that. So he's not even that skilled at it, but it, precisely because of that, I think you can sort of lose yourself in an activity sometimes because it doesn't have those pressures. And I talk about like my own fondness for cheesy piano rock playing on a keyboard here with my headphones in, so no one else has to listen to me. Like, writing is the thing I do as a job, and I hope I'm good at it and I want to get better at it, but it's quite high pressure because you sort of want it to work out and you want to earn a living by it. But no, I'm never going to earn a living by my piano playing, and that actually makes it more fun in a way.
Want your head and hair to feel cool and clean? Been going to extreme measures to cool your head off? Then get yourself a Manscaped. Don't be like Ollie and take your scalp from zero to hero with the new Scalp Buffer now. Use the discount code LOAF to get your 20% off.
Part of the problem for me seems to be that life in general has sped up. And for my thesis work now at Oxford, I partially wrote about modern life and how it's sped up. And there's a book by James Truslow Adams where he talks about the tempo of modern life. And there's an anecdote there about people in the upper Amazon who would rest, take breaks as they would walk so mm-hmm. that their soul could catch up with them. And I thought that was a really beautiful yeah. idea. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on it's called the slow movement, which advocates right. for like a slower pace of life. Do you see that as yeah. a practical solution to modern time-related anxieties, or is it just another kind of rebranding of the issue?
I think it's a bit of both, and I'd be fascinated to know how this connects with your thesis. I wonder if you've stumbled across a writer called Hartmut Rosa, who's written a book called I've forgotten his book about acceleration, but he's written a book called, I think it's called Social Acceleration, and also written a book called Resonance, which I reference a lot in my forthcoming book because he's really gets at a lot of these things. I think the slow movement is a really interesting example because on the one hand, right, yeah, we all need to slow down. On the other hand, when I come across the sort of examples of that movement in, I have sort of a problem with it, which is that I don't think the real way of, I don't think the real problem is that we're going fast and need to go slow. I think it's something more to do with allowing reality to unfold at the speed that it unfolds and not trying to use sort of willpower to force the pace. And so, you know, I think the problem with trying to speed read a novel, say, is like not that it's inherently better to read a novel slowly, but that you, a novel just takes a certain amount of time and you have to sort of surrender to its speed in order to benefit from it. I know, you know, English students at university with a major text to read each week don't want to hear this, but it's, you know, it's broadly true. And it's not actually the case that you need to go slow. It's the case that you sort of need to not use your willpower. And there can be something in the slow movement that is much more sort of willed. It's like, I'm going to do this really, slowly, when actually some things are probably better done more speedily. The thing that I always think is interesting is there's something called slow television. I expect you've run into in this, right? This is these like long videos on YouTube of like the train that goes from, I don't know, Oslo to the northern, to the Arctic Circle. And you just sort of get the image of the driver's view. And it's like 7 hours of footage and people find this sort of therapeutic. That train is not going slowly. You'd get injured if you stood in the path of that train. It's not actually that that what you're watching is slow. It's that it's not edited to take less time than it takes, right? It's just like, this is the speed at which reality unfolds. So for me, that's the real challenge. Like, as a sort of naturally quite impatient person and all the rest of it, like, letting things move fast when they need to move fast, letting them move slow when they need to move slow, letting my 7-year-old son take the time it takes for him to get his clothes on and leave the house, because I've learned that if I try to use my will to hurry that process, it'll take twice as long. Like, that's a really interesting confrontation with human limitation, more so than just like, we should go slower necessarily. That's my thoughts.
Yeah, as an English graduate, I can definitely relate. And I think, kind of what I've learned is that the structure of a book and the way that it's paced obviously reflects the meaning of that text. So if you try and read a summary or try and rush through it, it defeats the purpose of reading it at all.
Right.
But I suppose my question would be, following from that, how one can kind of strive in a society that has, at least to me, sped up and that does seem to require more of people. How can someone be successful if they're kind of not moving with the pace of those around them?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And obviously, you know, I don't want to give the impression that I, in my own personal life or my own work life, like, don't attempt to keep on top of my emails. Plenty of people I work with would give the impression that I don't attempt to keep on top of my emails, but I'm trying. And you know, that I can somehow make a living while completely ignoring deadlines or something. And this is not the case. I think you do have, that pressure is universal and there's no point sort of trying to resist it completely. On the other hand, I do think that where you can make the space in your day or in your life for pushing back against that, for not just immediately completely complying with the social pressure towards acceleration, if you can handle the discomfort that arises when you resist it, actually that is, I believe, totally helpful for thriving and surviving and for doing well and for, you know, having a successful career and making money and all the rest of it. There's an art historian who I've quoted at length, Jennifer Roberts, who has all her incoming students do this exercise where they have to stare at a painting for 3 hours, precisely because that's a sort of incredibly painful amount of time to be looking at a work of art. And you see, I did this for the 4,000 weeks, and you experience things in a completely different way if you can ride out that first hour of like, what am I doing here? This is awful. And And in the same way, I think if you can, you know, if you can bring patience to bear on, I mean, writing a book is a good example. Sorry, it's a bit of a cliche for me to talk about it, but it's the one I know most closely. If you can really be okay with making only a little bit of progress on any given day and not give in to that urge to keep going and going and going and then exhaust yourself and then turn the whole thing into a horrible psychodrama and you don't want to do it. If you can just write for a short period, but do it almost every day, your progress through the book is much, much faster than if you sort of are fixated on trying to meet the speed of which the wider society is moving. And I think, you know, creative solutions to problems come when you're willing to sort of just sit with them and not race forwards. And so I actually think it, ironically, I think it actually gets you to a lot of those goals more effectively anyway.
Mm. If you could, something I really enjoyed in the book, and which I felt maybe had a bit of a tinge of a left-wing angle to it, was your exploration of the reconceptualization of time slowly from kind of this typical medieval peasant or medieval serf who was farming on land to what we have today and how time has kind of become to be viewed as a resource. Maybe you could just walk us through that because I found it super interesting how it's tied into history.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always a bit evasive when on the sort of big causal arguments because I think so much, there's so many different things going on here. This is like human nature and evolutionary psychology, but it's also the history of industrialization and capitalism and technology. And there's lots in the sort of Judeo-Christian religious traditions that feed into this. But anyway, I do think that if you had been like a medieval peasant in like the North York Moors, where I'm speaking from now in the middle of the Middle Ages, you'd have had a very large number of problems, a terrible life in all sorts of ways, and a very short life expectancy. But I don't think you would have experienced problems that we think of as problems of time, like having too much to do or being in a rush or not feeling guilty for wasting time, just because that whole setup, like there's me and there's my time and I've got to manage it well today and I've got to use it effectively today. And if I don't, then it's, you know, I should feel bad about that or I might fall behind in the rat race. All of that, I think, comes with, first of all, the invention of clocks and that objective ideas about time that come from that. And then the Industrial Revolution and the sort of sale of time, the context of like the shift in a factory or a mill where you're, as a worker, you're selling an hour of your time rather than, you know, working in a piecework way. And that whole shift, I think, really, I mean, it's essential for organizing modern society. And I don't think we should go back to being medieval people on any level, but something is lost when you sort of only relate to time as this resource for being used, when you only can think of sort of measuring up your activities through the day against this kind of imaginary yardstick. Like, did I get through that in time? Have I got enough time before Friday's deadline to do this stuff? It's a very sort of tormenting way to live. And there is this other way of living that anthropologists call task orientation, right? Where it tends to be in communities that are very close to nature in the work they do, but like you just get up when the sun rises, you just milk the cows when the cows need milking, you just harvest the crops when the crops are ready to be harvested. It doesn't work to try to force it onto a schedule. So yeah, that's the change. I guess it is a bit political. I'm certainly not left-wing enough to think that like or Luddite enough to think that like everything that comes with industrialization and the objectification of time is all bad, but it definitely does something to the soul to live in a society that is only like that.
Well, look, yeah, it's definitely one negative consequence against many other positive ones. And the balance is really what we're looking for. Yeah. But I think maybe a hyperbolic example, which you could tell the listeners about, is the parable of the Mexican fisherman and the American businessman, which kind of sum up stupidity of yeah, seeing time as just one resource among others.
Yeah, this is a sort of like fable whose origins are lost to history, though somebody did contact me the other day and claim that they located the original source, which I now can't remember. So anyway, it's not my story, and it's a little bit, full of national stereotypes, but it does get at something important, which is, and so the story is about sort of hard charging, highly motivated American businessman who goes on vacation to Mexico and gets talking to a fisherman and asks him what he does. And he says, well, in the morning I go fishing for a couple of hours, enough, sell the fish at market or whatever. And then, and I can spend the rest of the day, drinking wine and, playing music in the sun with my friends. And, the businessman says, well, hold on a second. You're not thinking about this right. If you worked more, if you like really got efficient about this, if you put in a bunch more hours each day, doing the fishing, eventually you could like employ a whole fleet of fishing boats, and you could be like the manager of the company. Then you could make like millions and millions, and you could sort of, you wouldn't ever have to work at all eventually, right? You've just got this whole thing. And then finally, when you've got millions and millions, you can just retire early, like earlier than you otherwise would. And the fisherman says, well, and then what would I do? And the businessman says, well, then you could spend your days playing music and drinking wine in the sun with your friends. So, just to spell it out, in case it wasn't clear, I mean, this idea that you are on a quest for a kind of life that is in fact available to you now, that if you instrumentalize all your time to try to get to this point where you will have arrived, you're missing out on the possibility that a lot of those things are just the things that people want to do already, and that meaning is available to you in your life right here, instead of only at the end of a quest of productivity and efficiency. I remember, I've never found the source of this, but I remember reading an article, and then I just vanished, about a group of extremely wealthy tourists who were on some sort of very VIP trip, where when you've got like too much money, you have to like be taken on a very special kind of tour, otherwise nothing is interesting anymore. And seeing these amazing sights and dining at these most amazing restaurants. And I think like getting stuck in a first-class airport lounge at some point because of a delayed flight, and all just like getting chatting about like life or stuff or philosophy, I don't remember the details, and looking back on that as the highlight of the whole trip, not the pyramids at Giza and not the Michelin-starred restaurants, but just actually getting to chat and make friends with some people, which you can do without a fortune of hundreds of millions of dollars.
I think the Mexican fisherman parable is really tied up with what you call the limit embracing attitude to time. The idea that maybe we shouldn't instrumentalize everything. Could you maybe unpack that a little bit, and then we could talk about it?
Yeah, I think basically the instrumentalizing time in this way, I think the reason we do all of this stuff, the reason we go along with the acceleration of society, the reason we try to stuff more and more into our schedules, all the rest of it, is ultimately to resist feeling what it's like to actually be limited in life, to resist the sort of claustrophobic feeling that actually you've got a certain amount of time, certain amount of energy and attention, and you've just got to make choices about what you're going to be using it for, right? So the joy of optimizing and of working towards this moment in the future is that you don't quite have to take responsibility for the fact that this is life now. You get to be like, oh no, I'm just sorting everything out, and I'm getting into the position where I will later be able to do everything. So the limit embracing life is just like what happens when you step more authentically and fully into the situation you're actually in. And my new book, Meditations for Mortals, has this subtitle, 4 weeks to embrace your limitations and make time for what counts. It's like, my argument is that chasing this place where we're not limited anymore actually impedes us, like stops us from doing meaningful, interesting, impressive stuff in life, because we're always working towards this future moment where we're not limited and can finally start living properly.
I was listening to the interview with Chris Williamson when you went on his podcast. I think it was the second time. And something that struck me was this idea that people might be more impatient waiting in a queue when they can also look at the weather on their phone. So what I mean by that, for those listening, is that we have such control and such knowledge about so many things in life, be able to check the weather in 5 days, to be able to go 100 kilometers in less than a day, that when something doesn't go our way, we get extremely impatient. And I was wondering to what extent you think this issue with regards to time management is related to an issue of control and the feeling of humans wanting to control things.
I think it's totally related to control, and this topic of control in the new book, just like that's the point, right? It's like, okay, we I think since the beginning of humanity, on some level, we seek a kind of control that is not available to us. We control over the fact that, in fact, you know, we'd like to do more things. We'd like to not have to die. We'd like to not have to feel emotionally vulnerable in relationships. We'd like to be in more control than we have. But then you add in, among other forces, technology that seems to promise that control to be like just around the corner. And I think that is a big part of the problem today, right? It's like even just in the 1980s, frankly, you could dream of being able to send and receive hundreds and hundreds of letters in the course of a day if you wanted to. But like, so what? There was no technology, at least in widespread adoption, that made it feel like that was possible. And then email comes along, and then it feels like you ought to be able to send almost an infinite amount of messages. But of course you can't, because you're a human, and or reply to, perhaps would be more appropriate thing to talk about. It feels like, you know, in the days when you're just putting food into an oven and leaving it for 2 hours before it's cooked, you know, no one's worried about cooking food instantaneously. But when you can cook it in a microwave in 2 minutes, it gets really frustrating that isn't 0 minutes. And I don't know if in your lives you have context where there's like a shared microwave. Lots of people do in the corporate world and everything, you know, the office microwave. It's all, whenever you go to one of those, it is always stuck at 7 seconds or 6 seconds, which was the point at which the last person just like got so impatient they had to press cancel and get their food early, because there's something about that feeling of like, I'm almost God over time and reality, that is much more frustrating than like, you're nowhere near being God. So I think I think control is really like, yeah, runs through the heart of all this.
Yeah, to a certain extent, I think even if you can get that control, there's something still problematic there, or even if you can get still very close to it. So I'm going to use the example of Mario Salcedo, which you cite in the book. So for our listeners, Mario Salcedo, he was like a successful businessman in one venture or another. I can't remember what it was. And for the last about 25 years or so, has been living entirely on cruises. Fully in control of his time, because he runs an investment business or something for about 10 or so hyper rich individuals. And he spends all his time on the yacht, able to do whatever he wants on this huge cruise with diversions and fun things all around him. And yet you don't seem to think that quite strikes at happiness, or that there's something missing there. What does your intuition tell you about what's missing there?
Well, there's a lovely, I was just looking up, there's a short movie, which I think you can find fairly easily online, called The Happiest Guy in the World, about him. And I'm being terribly rude about him in the book, because I've got no grounds to say that he isn't happy. I'm really saying, if that were my life, it wouldn't be happy. And I think you can tell from this wonderful short movie that I don't think he is happy. But anyway, whatever. The basic point here is that this is somebody, the purpose he serves in my argument anyway, is that this is somebody who really does get to live life completely on his own terms. He wakes up in the morning and he can do anything he wants with his time. I mean, within the restrictions of being on a cruise ship, but like, you know, doesn't have to do laundry or cook meals, and it's all taken care of. And there's a real sense I get in the short movie, and I think if I was in that life, of it, that this is a big mistake about what gives time its value, that actually that kind of total individual sovereignty over your time is not something that you would ultimately want. So he's always sort of, you know, talking about his friends, but he really means the staff of the cruise line that he's a customer of, who are sort of obliged to throw him little birthday parties and say and ask him how he's doing. It's like there's something missing there. And I'm using that in the book to really make the point that actually you don't want total control, solo control over your time. You want your time to be synchronized well with other people's time to do anything, right? To be in a relationship, to launch a business, to be a political activist. Like, you need to have coordinated time and do things alongside other people. And yet there's a lot about our society, I think, that is increasingly sort of makes it harder and harder, at least outside of work itself, to get that kind of synchronization. And maybe this is different in a student environment, but certainly in my life, like, it is almost impossible to make a plan with like two other friends for us all to meet up. And it isn't because we're all the busiest people in the world. It's just because our time is not synchronized. We have spare time. It's just not the same spare time. And I think that kind of problem, which again, traditional societies that were more organized around, you know, everyone stops for the Sabbath and everyone does this on this day. Lots of disadvantages to that, but some big advantages as well.
Yeah. I hate to bring up my thesis again, but it really does interest me because I did talk about the way in which humans might be out of sync with a city, for example, or the urban environment around them, and how this lack of synchronization causes internal issues.
Yeah.
I suppose there is some balance that needs to be struck between not neglecting a collective time, yet nonetheless in the 21st century, being able to have time for our own pursuits and potential goals. You might have maybe answered this in some other way earlier on, but perhaps to hone in on that, how might you find and strike that balance between collective and personal?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, to take it to a sort of real extreme, there's a sort of a society in which everybody has to do everything at the same time. It's a totalitarian society. That's what it means on some level, right? That sort of total command of the lives of the citizens. So I'm not in favor of that. And I suspect there was something a bit totalitarian about certain kinds of, you know, older traditional societies where you didn't have any freedom to do things with your time. I think it's as simple really as kind of making a few commitments in your life that are sort of difficult to get out of. And that could literally be as mundane as, like, you know, joining a choir that meets on the same night every week. Could be as big as, getting married, which again is not completely reversible as a commitment, but it's, you know, pretty big deal to reverse it. So you're sort of, in all these cases, you're just sort of, you're giving away something to get something else, right? You're giving away the freedom to not go to the choir practice on a Wednesday night, or to only sing on the days that you feel like singing or something, right? You're, all these kind of so-called freedoms you're giving away because you have to be there at that time for as long as you're involved. And I like that example. I don't know if either of you have this experience, but my experience, I have experience singing choirs as a pretty bad singer. It's the classic example of the thing that is like greater than the sum of its parts. It's an extraordinary kind of transcendent experience to be part of a choir, even if only a handful of its members, not me, are like professional quality singers. But anyway, it could be anything. Join organizations, sign up to things, become a member of a religious organization if that's your thing. It's just commitments, basically, right? It's things where you voluntarily say, actually, I probably do have to be in that place at that time every Wednesday for the foreseeable future, or I actually do have to stop doing what I'm doing when my son wakes up because I decided to become a parent. So, you know, I've got things I have to do and that are not under my direct command all the time.
Well, I'm sure you're an amazing singer. But of course,
I'm really not an amazing singer. I benefit from the fact that no choir has enough tenors. It's brilliant. It's my main strategy.
Yeah, it's good. But the issue, of course, and I think this is perhaps why, and we haven't quite covered the appeal of having that individual time. This is perhaps why there is that appeal, is that when you do lock into those things, be it a family, be it, like you say, a choir, be it a sport, be it a religion, is that your time is then limited and it begins to get taken away from you. And in that way, the future can kind of serve as a bit of a drug in a way. And I wanted to maybe talk to you about how you think people who are trying to escape the limit embracing attitude see the future, and maybe how we should reconceptualize it as not something that we have so much control over and can put so many different things in.
Yeah, no, right. Great point. Yes, there's this, I mean, one of there's a quote from the philosopher Henri Bergson, which I mention in 4,000 Weeks, about how the future is so, it's so appealing to hope and dream and fantasize about the future, because basically, I'm paraphrasing, but basically in the future, no limits apply. And the future is just sort of hazy and you can give all the things. So like I can write sort of, you know, be an incredibly, I can be incredibly dedicated to my writing. I can spend a ton of time with my friends. I can be a really present parent, and I can spend half the year on silent meditation retreats, just so long as that's all happening in the future, because then I don't have to confront the fact that these limits apply. And so then it becomes quite easy to sort of put off all of those things or to misassign time to them in the present, because like it's later that you're really going to get involved in those things. Like the real moment is coming later. This life is provisional. I think there's something worth addressing. I don't know if you're interested in this, but like, I do think that there's a bit of an elephant in the room here about stages of the life cycle, right? I'm Generation X in my mid to late 40s. And on some level, these are things that sort of, they become more acute as you make your way through life. And also they seem sort of, it seems a lot more understandable to me that anybody in their early to mid 20s would think about the majority of life as coming later, right? Because it's just sort of mathematically, probabilistically likely to be true. I don't think that means that what we're saying here isn't true for people at every stage of life, but I do think that there's a role for building for the future, and there's a role for understanding that the future itself never arrives, and that you have to find the process and the present fulfilling if you're ever going to find life fulfilling. And I think those balances shift, and it may be that at the younger end of adulthood, it makes more sense to be a bit more, you know, to think about the future as being full of possibilities. It's very difficult once you're sort of 40 to convince yourself that the moment of truth in life is coming later. It's like, when is this happening? Right? It's like, is it going to be when I'm 60? I hope not.
Yeah. Do you think maybe like for a lot of people who are approaching kind of middle age, a lot of these truths which we're talking about, which for our younger audience might seem kind of fresh and quite daunting almost, the fact that you might have to lock down your time. Do you think that kind of comes naturally as you get a bit older? Some of these truths come to you a little bit, maybe some of the truths you wrote about in the book, you kind of came to naturally understand, or do you think people still, as they get older, kind of need to actively adopt that mindset in order to treat family, et cetera? In the right way. No, sorry. Carry on.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think it comes as a, you know, on some level, it's the original or one of the original sort of Jungian meanings of the midlife crisis, right? I think it comes as a crisis. I don't think anyone's really ready for the dawning realization of their limitations. I do think, you know, with 4,000 Weeks, it's been funny. On the one hand, something that a number of people have said to me is that they bought another copy of the book for their son or daughter who was going off to university or who was at university. And I'm always like, thanks for the purchase and best of luck. But I don't think I would have taken this advice very kindly if it had been given to me in a book form by my dad when I was at that stage of life. And I think to some extent, you know, that's not how it works. On the other hand, I think there's something really powerful about that some people do find in this perspective while in their 20s, you know, while not all that far through the span of adulthood. Firstly, because it's never too early to start contemplating these truths, which are true at every point in the life cycle, right? I mean, they're true for a five-year-old. It's just that, you know, doesn't occur to a five-year-old, but and it's probably a good thing that it doesn't. But you know, these truths about our limitations and about the speed of life and all the things we've been talking about are true at every point in the life cycle. And then just finally, also there that I think sort of productivity culture and YouTube productivity advice and the sort of all this stuff that is often very much aimed at people at the beginnings of their careers is so toxic in certain ways that actually there's a new need to sort of push back against it right from the start of a professional life, because the moment you set foot in that world, you're assailed with, you know, incredibly stress-inducing advice. And so we see all sorts of people complaining of burnout in their late 20s or early 30s, which used to be a thing that only ever happened to you when you were, you know, in 50 or something.
Yeah, I think the relationship between stages of life and perception of time is interesting. You mentioned Henry Bergson, and that's, he talks a lot, obviously, about the subjective understanding of time and experience of time in contrast to the objective one, which is, as you mentioned, perhaps maybe more prominent with the invention of clocks. But perhaps what the reason is that our perception of time is quite structured and controlled by the environments we find ourselves in. So if you're in university and you don't have anything to do that day on a Monday morning, you might experience time as more slow. But if you work a 9-to-5 and you're 45 years old and you're perhaps coming up towards retirement, for example, then perceptions of time also change. I'm not sure. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I think it's all heavily affected. I mean, time perception in general, I mean, this notion, this feeling that everyone has that time speeds up as they get older, which I think is something that you do start to perceive quite early on in adulthood. Like, I think, you know, if you have memories of summers that seem to last forever when you were a small kid, already it seems like something's not quite the same. And there's lots of research about why that should be the case. I think that the feeling of the future being abundant is one part of this, right? And it factually is abundant if you're, or likely to be abundant if you're younger and at an earlier life stage. And there's nothing wrong with sort of taking comfort and solace or finding that great. The risk is always that how you respond to that perception and whether you use it to sort of act like you've got all the time in the world in a negative sense, right? To sort of not step fully into the moment of life that you're in. And then I think you hinted at this a bit before, but like the routinization of time can really make it feel like it's slipping away very fast. As soon as you get into a sort of corporate setting, although there are further and fewer between these days, but where like everything is on rigorous hours, whole weeks can just sort of, and months can just sort of vanish into nothing. So one thing I like about my life now as a freelancer living in the countryside, I'm pretty busy and got lots of family responsibilities and all the rest of it, but actually the lack of complete predictability in it makes time feel more expansive than it did in a office setting.
I think maybe one of the responses people often have to this feeling that time is slipping away is to try and pay attention to it in every moment. To try super hard to be in the present in what we call like the age of distraction.
Yeah.
And maybe it's necessary. I've got a funny anecdote. Lucas is Maltese. So we were just, me, him, and another friend, Faris, went out to go see him in Malta, and we took out on his aunt's boat. And we were kind of going down the Maltese coastline, right? Which is kind of one of these atelic activities. It's beautiful. You know, you're driving along the coast, and me and Lucas were sat in the two driver's seat, and our friend at the front just purely by instinct picked up his phone and just started scrolling through TikToks like this. So maybe there is something to needing to be in the present. But you do say that trying too hard to be in the present often means you can fail. So how can we find this balance?
Right. No, I love that anecdote, it's not what you should be doing in that situation. But if you sort of decided to, perhaps because you were pressured by your friends, you know, to put the phone away and to try very, very hard to really be in the moment, you'd run into the same problem to do with kind of willing the use of time that we talked about before when it comes to slowing down and all the rest of it. It's really something about the act of trying to do that pulls you out of the moment. I think that it's very difficult to sort of recommend what to do, because the moment you try to do something about it, you're
you're committing the problem that we're talking about. I think the two things that help or that helped me are firstly a sort of intellectual understanding, which is like, you already are in the moment all the time by definition. This isn't a place to get to. It's just a place to realize or accept that you already are. So you can sort of relax that I must be present in the moment kind of energy and just be like, here I am. And then secondly, you can put yourself you can build into your life the kind of experiences that broadly speaking tend towards you sort of losing track of time. And that's different for different people. So you can go on trips into nature and you can make sure you make time for the kinds of hobbies that you find, in which you find flow, playing musical instruments, maybe sport, whatever it might be. Not because you're then going to approach each one with this, like, I am now going to really enjoy this experience, but just because your life is naturally going to be more full of the kinds of things in which you're more likely to fall into that without thinking about it. But this is this very complicated sort of Taoist notion of effortless effort, right? It's very difficult, or not complicated, but like you can really sort of confuse yourself if you decide you're going to go through life with that attitude. You sort of just have to let it happen.
Yeah, I guess it all comes together as well in Eckhart Tolle and the power of now. It's quite a powerful idea to need to be in that present moment. But I was earlier this year doing some traveling in Vietnam, and while I was there, I noticed myself actively trying to be in the moment, to try and switch my mindset. I just finished my final exams, so I'm trying to change my mindset from feeling this need to do something, and at the same time I was feeling myself needing to be present and needing to get rid of that need. So it was a little bit paradoxical in that sense. And I think there's another angle to it as well, which was, I had a friend, and he'll know that I'm talking about him. He sometimes tells me, oh yeah, I'm in Africa right now, and I'm trying to find the balance between taking pictures and videos and actually enjoying it for myself. Where he goes to a concert and he's trying to find the balance between how much he should be filming it so that he can post it online and enjoy it. So I suppose that links to social media quite powerfully, which is perhaps the number one buzzword when it comes to the age of distraction. And in your book, you think that the issue with social media perhaps goes much deeper than turning us away from the work we're supposed to be focusing on, for example, but instead changing the way we see the world and perceive it. Could you perhaps expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, no, totally. And I'm the thing that I was mentioning there, I think it's an interesting question in the case of your friend, right? Because it's not the case that collecting things in order to post them on social media is somehow like inherently a bad thing to do. People build interesting and fulfilling careers around doing this well. It takes a completely different sort of psychological inner gesture than showing up for the experience that's unfolding. One of the things that I write about the social media in the book is just that, like, when I think about what spending too much time on Twitter did to my brain. It wasn't just that I spent an hour on Twitter and I should have used it more constructively. It was that I'd find myself like hours later walking along the street, like muttering to myself, arguing with some idiot who didn't know I existed, right? I hadn't actually responded to them on Twitter necessarily. I just sort of seen these kind of absurd nonsense. Other people, I think, see a lot of stuff about knife crime, for example, on social media, which when it happens to somebody is absolutely terrible. But of course, social media is structured to make it seem like it's happening every minute to everyone. And then you're going to walk down your street in a different way than you would have walked down your street before because of what that sort of attention-based environment that is just trying to compel you, that's all it cares about, has done to your brain. So that is, I don't know how it exactly relates to the question of like looking at things and having experiences in order to record them on social media. But it's just a reminder of how non-neutral these spaces are in terms of the influence they exert on our lives. And I think the thing is just to be as conscious as you can about that. And if from that conscious place you choose to say, you know what, this holiday is not going to be as amazing as it could have been as a holiday because I will be collecting lots of imagery for my social channels. But the flip side of that is I'll have some amazing social channels and that gives me pleasure and meaning. Like, that's fine. But it's a question of knowing that that's what you're doing.
I think you're right that social media apps are definitely non-neutral. And in trying to get engagement, like you say, they do prioritize certain issues, which they know are going to get more clicks. Knife crime is just one. Anytime there's a political election coming up, we definitely know that the culture wars, certain particular questions about bathrooms, for example, will be huge and completely blow up, or some part of the wall in America will completely blow up when there's maybe more important issues to consider. And so in that way, the engagement that the social media apps are trying to drive is really a political problem. And you say in the book, political crises require political solutions. So without putting you on the spot too much, what do you think about the way that social media apps are legislated, and how do you think they might be legislated differently or dealt with differently in order to counteract this tendency?
Yeah, I don't mind being put on the spot. I just don't know what should happen in terms of regulation. I don't know on the sort of first order level of like what's the morally right level of regulation. And I then also don't know what to do about the fact that it seems clear from what's happening on the former Twitter at the moment anyway, when I do go back there, which is less frequently than before, that, you know, anything like that immediately gets sucked into the conflict that's already there. So if you, you know, I don't have a clear sense of whether the sort of legal actions have been taken against people for incitement to violence over the recent weeks have gone too far into something that is not just the punishment of incitement, but is a limitation on free speech. I don't have a clear enough sense of those cases, but you know that the moment that anything is done or said or proposed to regulate things like this, that just then itself feeds into that whole furious anger and makes the problem 10 times worse. I do think that I find myself on the side of people who think, like, you know, there's no reason why children should be on most of these kinds of networks. There's no reason why people at, you know, school should be have access to web connected smartphones all through lessons, or even all through the school day. I think things like that, it's a little easier to see. It's a little harder to be clear about what limits there should be on sort of grown adults choosing to spend all their days arguing furiously about things. So I'm giving a very answer that probably sounds evasive, but I just don't really know. One thing I do think is, and this is to do with the sort of how it feels to be limitless online and all the rest of it, is that, like, to the extent that our laws about incitement to violence or libel or harassment are basically okay, and there's certainly criticisms that can be made of them, like, the idea that that doesn't apply just because you're in an online space, I think, is very sort of very appealing to a lot of people, but complete nonsense. And I'm all for the sort of equal enforcement of those kinds of laws in social media spaces as well, because it seems like people really feel like it's a different reality in a way that ultimately it isn't, because we're just the same people behind the screen. There you go. How about that for a non-answer?
No, I think Alistair Campbell made that exact same point in the last episode of The Rest Is Politics. But anyway, on that note of relative uncertainty, I was wondering if you could leave our audience with any advice for the uncertainty ahead of them in their own uncertain futures.
I think one of the most powerful expressions of the sort of limit embracing life when it comes to people at a student stage and on the threshold of a career and all the rest of it is to do with the limited ability that we have to know and understand the future, to plan, to sort of dictate what happens in the future. I wish that someone had said to me when I was sort of fretting about all these matters, I wish someone had mentioned the words of Carl Jung giving advice to somebody who's feeling directionless in life, where he writes this letter and he says, if you want to build a meaningful life, all you need to worry about doing is like the next most necessary thing. That's his phrase. This comes up also in the context of, there's a song in the movie Frozen about only doing the next right thing. So take your source as you wish, but just this notion that because we are just right here, because we find ourselves as limited humans always just right here and limited to this moment in time, all you can ever really do is take what seems to be the next right decision. You don't really need to worry about any of them that come after that. And you don't need to be sure that it's going to work out, because you can't be. And I think that I would just, you know, that's the piece of advice that I think is perhaps most useful. It's like, you're going to make an intuitive decision about the very next move, and then you're going to do it again. And you're going to do it again. And the big secret is you'll still actually be doing it when you're 48. But it seems, even though it seems when you're younger, like at some point you'll just figure it all out. So far, the evidence from my life does not suggest that you do.
Well, thank you very much, Oliver. And as we come to the end of the interview, many of you want to get to know Oliver and his work a bit better. For you, the next most necessary thing might be to get to know his work. So we'll leave a link to 4,000 Weeks down in the description. And if there's a pre-order link yet, Oliver, I don't know if there's a pre-order link yet.
There is. It's all at my website, oliverberkman.com. And this is a similar color palette, different book, Meditations for Mortals. Pre-orders are so valuable if anyone feels so moved. Yeah.
Well, everybody check that out. And thank you so much, everyone, for listening. We'll see you in the next episode. This is The Loaf Podcast, signing off.
Hey, guys. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Oliver Berkman. Make sure to like and subscribe if you did enjoy it, and leave a comment with your thoughts down below. You can click right here to watch our interview with James Nestor for more advice on how to live a better life. Stay tuned and see you next time.